You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Today we're talking about Cold War espionage, East Germany and Berlin with Spybury host Shane Whaley. Shane runs the Spybury podcast at spybury.com. Their goal is to encourage people to read new spy novels, revisit an old espionage classic, and discuss them with their community of like-minded spy fans. It's great fun, and if you like spy books, I highly recommend his podcast. So, settle in for a wide-ranging and hopefully interesting conversation with my good friend Shane Whaley. Hi, Shane. How are you?
Fantastic. Great to speak to you again, Ian. It's been a few months.
It has indeed. It's flown by, but loving the Spybury podcast.
Thank you. It's very kind. Loving doing it. Speaking to some fantastic people and, it's devastating my bank account, my bank balance with all the book recommendations, but there's worse ways to spend one's money, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, for those people that aren't familiar with Spybury, can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. Spybury is a spy podcast for fans of spy books and spy movies, both fact and fiction. We interview spy authors, intelligence experts, and spy fans. Our goal is to encourage people to read new spy novels or maybe revisit an old espionage classic and discuss them with our community of like-minded spy fans. Now, the genesis of the podcast was I was boring my friends and family to tears when I would read a Le Carre book or, you know, a Dayton-Berlin game set and match, and I just read this great book by Len Dayton, and this happened, and that happened, and they're just rolling their eyes because they're not just going,
Len who?
Exactly, yeah. And a lot of my friends are, you know, love talking about football and women, but not necessarily about espionage and fiction and Cold War. So I figured, hey, you know, there's got to be other people like me out there. Let's start a podcast and a Facebook group. And we're getting, I think it's about 3,000 downloads a week, which I'm very, very humbled and honored that people invest an hour listening to the show. A vibrant Facebook group with over 600 spy fans who are on there now. And it's a group that I really see as an extension to the show because people come on and talk about the interviews or some of the guests are on there. So it's a continuation of the show and building a community of like-minded fans. And there is some overlap, of course, with the Cold War because my special interest is Berlin, particularly the GDR, both from the espionage perspective, but also the politics and the aesthetics and the history of the GDR. So there's a little bit of Cold War stuff going on there as well.
Yeah, we've got something to talk about there, I think, Shane. A bit of meat there to get into. Why the interest in espionage? Where does that come from, Shane?
Well, I guess it started off as a kid, like most of us, being a big fan of the James Bond movies, and then actually picking up an Ian Fleming book and with disgust realizing that the books were very different from the movies. And then it took a few more years before I picked up Fleming again and really enjoyed the books of Fleming. That led me on to Le Carre. And I realized that as a kid, you know, I really liked the fantasy side of the James Bond world. But as I grew older and understanding life a bit more and certainly reading a lot more history, books like The Spy Who Came from the Cold or Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the Bernard Sampson books under Dayton really resonated with me because these were not super secret agents that, you know, could kill 200 men whilst they're having, you know, a glass of whiskey and a blonde on the other arm. You know, these were spies who, many of them didn't even fire a single shot. In fact, I was just reading Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I think for the third or fourth time recently, and at the end scene with George Smiley, he's going to capture the traitor. You know, he looks at his gun in his jacket and you don't even know what kind of gun it is. You know, Le Carre doesn't go into this whole chapter about the firearm that the protagonist is using, it doesn't matter. Mm. And that for me kind of really resonated. It was a lot of the geopolitics that went on behind why spies were having to do what they have to do. It's a fascinating subject. And I enjoy both fact and fiction. So I love the real life history, and I try and alternate my reading between one, you know, nonfiction espionage book and then fiction.
Yeah. And would you like to be a spy?
Not on your life. Now, I was at SpyCon a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was on a panel, bit of a silly panel, really, but it was called Le Carre versus Fleming. And I said to the audience, when I read Fleming, I want to be a secret agent. When I read Le Carre, I want to be an accountant. Because when you read Le Carre spies, there is no way I want to be Alec Lemus. No. There is no way I want to be Ricky Tarr in Tinker Tailor. There's no way I want to be any of these guys who are living on their wits. They're always waiting for the knock on the door. Yeah, you know, it kind of sounds glamorous. You're living behind enemy lines in East Berlin, but one slip and you're executed. No, thank you.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to have Alec Lemus's liver either, would you really?
No, not at all. In fact, I was just reading today about Richard Burton. I was quite surprised. Apparently Burton said, because there's a scene in The Spy Who Came from the Cold where he hits the shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper's played by Bernard Lee. Mm-hmm. And Richard Burton turned around and said, Bernard Lee, of course, went on to play M in the Bond movies, was the only person who ever drunk him under the table. It's like, wow, Bernard Lee, eh? Be some night out.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned that you're interested in the non-fiction side of espionage. Is there any particular case that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think top of that is the Cambridge spies for sure. There's been so much written about them, and it's something that now I think we can all just kind of scratch our heads about how they got away with what they did. So that's always top of mind. And then, of course, we'll get onto this, but I think one of my favorite, and I'll call it nonfiction in air quotes, is Marcus Wolff's Man Without a Face. And I put it in air quotes because, of course, we don't really know what's true and what's not in his book. Mm-hmm. Can't take him at his word. But for me, that's one of the best espionage books ever written.
Yeah, certainly from a biographical point of view, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, it is one of these ones where you do sometimes fit. You're taking it with a pinch of salt.
You have to, because you know, of course, he's not around now. There's no way of corroborating what he's saying. I think where I believe him is where he talks about a lot of the activities of his department in terms of foreign agents into West Germany. I would believe most of that. I guess where I disagree with Wolf a lot is, or with what he's saying is, how he became to be a critic of the GDR. I'm like, were you really, mate? You know, were you really, before the wall came down, were you really a critic of Honecker to his face or to Milka? Or are you just saying that now because, you know, history?
Yeah, yeah. And I think he sort of says that he knew nothing of the Red Army faction terrorists that were being given haven in East Germany as well. Yet he was... You know, he was in charge of the overseas intelligence service. So, yeah,
but I don't believe him. Yeah,
no, I don't. But I agree. It is an absolutely fascinating read, and does give you, you know, sort of a first-hand insight into how effective the East German intelligence was.
For such a small country, you know, really, when you look at it, what they were able to do, particularly when you think of the Gunter Guillaume case, of putting a man that close to Willy Brandt, undetected for so long,
yeah,
as well as the Romeo agents, you know, pretty incredible what Wolf and his guys got up to.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, they've obviously, you know, they were one country in effect. So being able to place agents in West Germany was not as difficult as, you know, Britain trying to place an agent in the Soviet Union or something like that.
They definitely had that advantage, I agree.
But I think it's Gabby Gast, who they had high up in NATO, and Rainer Rupp, who he claims that he you know, he's another one of these people that claims they prevented World War III, but there's quite a long list of those.
And I think he has a good claim. I mean, the short story here was, you know, obviously watching Deutschland 83, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I didn't know anything about Abel Archer. And going to the German Spy Museum and suddenly reading about Rainer Rupp Topaz, that it was him. He was the one who said to the Soviets, no, they're on maneuvers. It's an exercise. It's not the real thing. And you can just imagine, you know, the Politburo getting all this information about NATO movements. I mean, look at what's going on today without getting political in Syria. You don't know what to believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, you imagine it back then, the height of the Cold War. I think he's got a good claim. I think, yeah, you know, there could have been a strike. Who knows what may have happened. Yeah.
Well, I think he tells the story that he managed to copy the entire document that listed what they were doing in Abel Archer. And by providing it to the Stasi and obviously the Soviet intelligence as well, because they could see they had all the numbered pages, they knew that nothing was, you know, hidden.
Yeah.
There. But yeah, it fascinating, you know, fascinating stories. And it does beg the question of, you know, did they find them all? Or are there others out there that are,
there have to be,
you know, have just gone to ground and are happily mowing their lawns in Munster or Stuttgart?
Yeah, no, that has to be. Yeah, I agree. No, I don't think we got them all at all. I think there were plenty that were sleepers for a long, long time.
Yeah, well, if you find any, send them my way, because I'd love to have a chat with them, Shane.
There we go. We'll have to get that little voice distorter thing, right? So we'll be able to recognize them. And yeah, no, absolutely.
Now, your interest in East, because you've got a particular interest in East Germany. What started that?
It's a curious story. So back in the 80s, I was a bit of a nerd as a kid, and I used to collect stamps. And you used to send away a pound note. Remember those? And a pound note, a lot of money then. Once a month, you send it off to this address, and you just get back a mixed bag of stamps from all around the world. And for some reason, this guy kept sending me, most of the stamps I got was certainly Eastern Europe, and the majority of them were from the GDR. So I had this collection, and I thought, oh, I'm going to specialize in the GDR stamps. And I would go down to Swansea Library, where I grew up, because this was pre-Google, can you believe? And, you know, try and read up on Dresden or Leipzig or Karl Marxstadt, all the places that were mentioned on a stamp, or if a person was mentioned on a stamp. And that was my way of, you know, enjoying the hobby and learning some history. And I used to get some very weird looks, of course, at Swansea University, because there weren't many, you know, spotty 13-year-olds asking for, you know, stuff on Brecht or Ulbricht or whatever it may be.
The collected works of Erich Honecker, yeah.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely. So I'd be in there looking for this stuff or ordering it. So that was how my interest started in the GDR. And then, of course, 89, the wall comes down, etc. And I just could not understand as a young teenager how a whole country could just evaporate. And I had this whole collection of stamps. I'm like, wow, this whole thing is gone. It's disintegrated. I say vanished.
Yeah.
How can that be? So that interest always stayed with me. You know, what happened to that country? What happened, you know, to some of the people on the stamps or those towns, and what happened to the people of East Germany? So I'd always kept, you know, an interest in the Cold War, the GDR. And then I was fortunate to go there. I'm trying to think the first year I went to Germany, I believe it was just a couple of years after the fall of the wall. I think, you know, I actually tell lines about 10 years later, late 90s, early 2000s. And just going around and seeing the Cold War sites, just my interest in it was renewed.
Yeah.
And again, I started reading. Unfortunately, I don't have my original stamp collection that got lost years ago, but I started collecting stamps again. So I do have a pretty good collection here, picking up books and bits and bobs and, you know, really trying to read as much as I could about the GDR. And I think that the interesting thing about your show and your interest in Cold War is, you know, neither of us are, I know you're involved with the Historical Society, but, you know, we're amateur historians in a way. And I even kind of wince saying that, you know, I can't pretend to be an expert on this stuff. I'm just a guy who is fascinated by the era. I will say, and for the record, I am not a supporter of communism. A supporter of Honecker and the Berlin Wall, not at all. What fascinates me is, you know, how that country lasted for the time that it did, how it collapsed, what life was like in East Germany, what was the East German mindset. Fascinating. And even now, I'm very lucky. The company I work for, our head office is actually in Prenzlauer Berg in East Berlin. And I'm just able to go and wander those streets. And I just have so many questions and ask myself what it was like to be here. Or I see a person of a certain age and wonder, did they grow up in East Berlin? Did they grow up behind the wall? What did they really think about the world? What was their worldview? And it's burning questions that to this day I still have. And like you, I love Twitter. There are some fantastic people on Twitter that share some amazing photographs or articles. And I'm learning so much about the GDR from Twitter and the wonderful people that post on there.
Well, we've got some other interviews lined up from some of those people. So
fantastic.
I'll leave it just standing there. So you're enticed.
I am.
I'm intrigued by East Germany. I think because, you know, I did visit Berlin before the war came down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that whole, you know, a country split in half on the basis of ideology, and Berlin particularly, you know, a city split in half. So, you know, like Trafalgar Square or Times Square, having a wall running across the middle of it, and, you know, one side is one ideology and the other side is another ideology. I think the other thing is, and these are interviews that I would love to do, as you were talking about, is with people who actually lived in East Germany.
Yes.
And particularly what it felt like when your country just disappeared overnight. I mean, I can't even get my head around that.
No, absolutely. And again, there are so many different viewpoints. There are people who obviously absolutely embrace that, and there are other people that are very, very sad about it. The other week, I wish I'd had my recorder with me, my gadgets, because this would have been great for your show. I was flying back from Berlin, got talking to my seatmate who left East Germany after the fall of the wall, and she lives in Canada and brought up her family there. And we talked about her time growing up in East Germany and raising two kids. And not once did she criticize or condemn the government of the GDR. Not once did she bring up the Stasi. All she talked about were the positives of living there. Mm. It was just a fascinating conversation, and I just kept stum. You know, I just let her go on. You know, I just like, wow, you know, this is a fascinating conversation where she was talking about, you know, her free university education, which of course, you know, only certain people got. It wasn't free for everybody. Unless you were the,
yeah, you had to toe the line to some degree to,
and you had to have working class parents.
Yeah.
If you were the children of the intelligentsia, they didn't want university, which is nuts in itself. And she was also sharing with me that, you know, a cousin, what was it? Yeah, a cousin of hers had gone over the wall, escaped. And her old man, or the cousin's father, was pretty high up in the army. He got drummed out of the army. The whole family got, you know, taken off and interrogated and watched and everything else. That was the only part of the conversation where she talked about anything negative, and that she was never allowed to speak to that side of the family again.
Wow.
Just amazing to think the guy got stripped of all his honors and everything else. And yeah, all because, you know, his daughter escaped and he probably knew nothing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And just talking to her, you know, the funny thing, she did tell a funny story, which I think you'd enjoy. So the night that, you know, the wall fell, pretty much, she was working nights in some factory. So she didn't know about what had happened at Bornholmerstrasse. And all her colleagues were late to work for the morning shift. And they eventually turn up, you know, stinking of booze, and they hadn't had any sleep. And she's like, this is just not good enough, you know, that you have to come to work. You have a duty to the country. You can't just turn up drunk. And they're like, what are you on about? Have you not seen the news? She's like, no, what? And then they explained to her, and she wouldn't believe them until she went home. I mean, that's the side you don't see, right? You know?
Yeah. But those stories are really what I want to try to make this podcast about, because it's just hearing that from somebody, because you just immediately think, well, it spread like wildfire and everybody knew about it by midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. But
she didn't. I mean, there's no internet, no phones. You know, I presume she wasn't listening to the radio at the time, or I don't know what East German radio was saying about it, if anything.
Yeah.
And I really wish I'd taken her email address so I could have connected you to her, because she was just, you know, fascinating to talk to.
Well, if you're listening, you know where I am.
There you go.
Now, you mentioned you've collected some GDR or Cold War items. Can you you know, give us a little bit of detail on what you've got.
Yeah, it's very eclectic. I was just in my little room. So I moved up to Station V 2 years or so ago, and it was great because I used to live in shoeboxes in New York and London. So it was great to get the stuff out of the boxes. And there's this little den which the previous owners, their kids were in. So, you know, it's a little door, adjoining door into one of the rooms upstairs. It's kind of hidden away. And we call that East Berlin. Because up on the wall, I'll send you a photo, maybe up with the show notes. I have a framed portrait of Erich Honecker.
Well, I remember you talking to me about that, and what was the you told your wife who that was?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
No, it depends. What did I tell her?
I think you told her that it was a picture of your grandfather, who was a trade union leader in Wales.
That's right. And sometimes, you know, with others, I have to say it's, you know, it's a trade union official or it's grandfather or whatever else. But yeah, I mean, that's it's quite funny. And even I remember having that portrait up when I lived in Cambridge, and people come to the house. It's fascinating. You know, people would recognize Gorbachev or Khrushchev, or Stalin, but you know, Honecker, we've laughed about this. You know, he looks like a librarian. He doesn't look like a leader of a communist country.
Not at all.
Very anonymous looking guy. So people just assume it is a trade union official or my granddad.
Brilliant.
So I have the portrait up on the wall. I do have a full Stasi uniform. I have, you know, not as many as you, Ian, but I have a fair few books on the GDR. And very eclectic there. Over big massive book, which is the history of the SED, which you need a magnifying glass to read it. I mean, just looking at these books are incredible. I have a lot of military medals and badges. I actually have a box full of one border guards, a major Canis, I think his name was. All his medals and certificates from his entire 20-year service in the Grenz Trooper. Yeah, and I bought it on eBay off a collector, and I tried to find out, hey, you know, do you know anything about the family? Because, you know, I really would want to find out a bit more the story behind these medals. Unfortunately, he didn't know a lot about it, so I have to do a wee bit more digging there. And some other things I've got, which are, I would say, not the norm that you would expect to have. So I've got this whole photograph collection that a U.S. congressman took in the 70s. He was obviously on some study trip to Germany and went to East Berlin, and he took a load of photos, and they were for sale because the guy had passed away and it was part of his estate, and they were just selling everything off. So I got them really cheap, and that's the kind of thing I really enjoy. Yes, when you go to Germany now and to Berlin, there's lots of great books and some picture books. What I really enjoy are that snapshot of the real East Berlin. And yeah, I'm sure he had minders and everything else, but he was able to take his own pictures. And it's a very interesting look at East Berlin. I also have a lot of these coffee table picture books of the DDR. And some of them are propaganda because they're wanting to show the West, hey, look how ultra-modern our centers are. And others are, you know, for the population of the GDR. And I really enjoy leafing through those books. And, you know, like we were talking earlier on, just imagining what life was like in East Germany, and also how it's changed from that, what it is today. Because as you know, and I guess we shouldn't be lamenting this, I guess it's a good thing, but I can't help but feel a wee bit sad that the Cold War sites and the GDR sites in Berlin are getting less and less. As things are being replaced and renovated, there's not as many of those sites around anymore. Or, of course, they're still there, but you can't really picture it as a Cold War site. Which is good for German progress, but not good for sad old geeks like us. That want to see this stuff.
What would you say is your most prized item then that you've got there? And you can say it's the bit of Berlin Wall I gave you.
You know, that actually, though, it's funny you mentioned it. It is definitely up there because you got that from the Berlin Wall. It's not from some guy's, you know, back garden in Kiel.
No.
you know, and that's the thing. I always giggle. Even now, they're still selling, you know, fragments of the Berlin Wall. I'm convinced the Berlin Wall must have been bigger than the Great Wall of China, because, you know, we're in 2018 and they're still selling bits of it. So, but no, I have that pride of place up on my mantelpiece, and I do look at it sometimes and imagine what stories it could tell. I think it's a tough question, to be honest, because I've got so many great things in my collection. Like, I love my stamp collection because it reminds me of my youth learning about the GDR, and there's so much history in stamps. But I think if I had to pick anything, it would be a book that's quite pricey to get hold of now. And it's actually called Honecker From My Life.
Oh, is it? And, you managed to get the English version?
I managed to get the English biography, isn't it? It is.
Wow. And it's in
color. And I want to read you, if I may, there's a publisher's preface. I'll quickly read it for you. I wonder if you can guess who wrote this. As the publisher of the series Leaders of the World, I have the honor of presenting to the public the third volume, which deals with the life and work of Erich Honecker, General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Socialist Unity Party of Germany and Chairman of the Council of State of the German Democratic Republic. As represented by Erich Honecker, the German Democratic Republic, together with the Soviet Union and the other countries of the socialist community, is a member of the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance and one of the states of the Warsaw Treaty. In international politics and in the struggle for peace and disarmament, it plays an increasingly important part. The 30th anniversary of the foundation of the GDR in October 1979 is a fitting occasion for the publication of this book. Do you want to have a guess who wrote that?
Are they English or American or?
English.
English.
And it wasn't Jeremy Corbyn.
Robert Maxwell.
Bang, you got it. You got it.
Hey, because he ran Pergamon Press, didn't he?
And that's who published this book.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten about that till I picked it up earlier today.
How many pages is it? I mean, does it cover his arrest by the Gestapo and stuff like that?
There are 500 pages.
Wow.
And what's fascinating with this is his address in the appendices, the address delivered at the ceremony to mark the 5th anniversary of the GDR, lots of tables, lots of propaganda stuff, and chapters, you know, written as a child with young Spartacus, illegal activity in the Ruhr, the years in prison, peace flight to the East, youth for socialism and peace. Trust in the strength of the people.
God, they don't write them like that anymore, Shane.
It could go on and on. really, socialist cultural policy. But I find this stuff fascinating. I love reading the propaganda, and I love reading what they put forward as policy.
Yeah.
I love picking up the Marxist-Leninism books. I mean, they're just so dry.
They are just so turgid.
Yeah, so this is a book that I'll cherish because it was expensive. It's hard to find because it's in English.
Yeah. I've been looking for one of those, and it's been out of my price range.
Yeah. No, I was lucky with this one. Yeah. It was still expensive, but was in my budget. Yeah. And then there's things, you know, a lot of badges that I've collected. I like the, what do they call? There's a particular word when you used to write off to a radio station and get the card back.
You got a few of those then?
Got a few of those from RBI, Radio Berlin International.
Right.
Which are, you know, and what I like about them is not just from that they're from RBI, it's like they were sent out to people in England that heard heard their show. And of course, RBI was the communist radio station that was broadcasting to Western Europe about the what they considered was the true story of the East to counter some of the propaganda that was coming from the West.
It gets a little mention on my intro. It's one of the last pieces on there.
Brilliant.
On the intro there. But I've also on the intro, I've got, it's a piece of Radio Moscow, and they talk about so-and-so from Thornton Lafarde in Lancashire. And I've always thought about, shall I see if I can find him? Because he wants to hear about more news on Anglo-Soviet relations or something.
Incredible. And that is called a QSL card. And I'm not being clever. I Googled it. So it's, a Q code message, apparently. Anyway, so I've got a few of those. And also, talking about propaganda, I think something else that I really enjoy in my collection is the Democratic German Report. I've got about 50 copies of those.
Now, that's real hardcore propaganda, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. So that was edited by John Peet, who we'll probably talk about a little bit later on. He defected from Reuters in the West to the East, and he wrote this newspaper, and it's basically, outing people in the West German government with a Nazi past, because, you know, the GDR were always saying that, yeah, West Germany is just it's a fascist state. All the ex-Nazis are running it. You know, nothing's changed. So he went to great levels to out these people in the newspaper. And he, it's funny if you think about in modern terms, you know, Searchlight magazine in the UK, which mm-hmm. outed Nazis in the UK. It's very similar to that, but these were all written in the 50s. I haven't read each and every single one of them, I must confess, because they are a wee bit dry.
Yeah. No, I've seen some of them on eBay. And,
yes.
You know, they're trying to link, you know, almost everybody in the West German government to a Nazi past.
Yeah, I remember the one I was reading in the Democratic Journal Report, and it was basically saying how Adenauer had groveled to the Nazis and had written this letter when he was mayor of whatever city he was, I forget now, and how, you know, they'd reproduced this letter they got where he'd said to this Nazi, hey, I was always good to the Nazi party. You know, and it's like, wow, they've really gone for him. It's just fascinating reading, yeah. Whether some of this is true or not. It's just, okay, this is what they're churning out. And I think for us, what's interesting, Ian, is this was going out in English.
Yes.
So it was how they were trying to counter some of the negative press about the communist world and about the GDR in particular.
Yeah. Go on.
No, I mean, that's also a really important part of my collection.
So what are you still hoping to collect? What's your... you know, what's on your wish list there?
Well, there's not a lot left that I really want, if truth be told. You know, I do sort of scour eBay to be surprised by something. I've got most of the books I want. And of course, it's very frustrating that most of the really good books on the GDR are written auf Deutsch. And my German is great. So, you know, I've got some here, which one day I hope I'll be able to read. But it does kind of put me off buying those. I think... I was going to say like a Makarov pistol and a Makarov holster would be good, but then I get worried about getting raided. Although, you know, I live in the US, probably legal to have one of them. That would be good. I would also love, we talked about this before, there's authentic GDR border signs that are out there, like plaques. And I was eyeing one up a couple of months ago, and the guy wanted $500 for it. And I tried to get him, you know, to talk him down. I can't imagine there's huge demand for this thing, but he played hardball and he's like, well, I'm not in a rush to sell it either. So if you change your mind, drop me an email. So I wasn't able to get it. And there's plenty of
that, those sort of things are pretty easy to copy, I would have thought.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. There is a lot of those repros around. And most sellers are honest about that, which is good. But even this one, I was like, you know, what's the story behind it? And he couldn't tell me. And, you know, when I buy something, it's a bit like those medals I bought of that border guard major. You know, I really want to know a bit more about it rather than just, oh, here's a plaque. You know, I'd love to know which part of Germany it was taken from and, you know, who took it away or whatever else. And I know you can't always get that backstory, but that's what makes the history come to life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the provenance.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned from Antiques Roadshow anyway. Now, just we talked about Berlin, and I'm very envious that your head office is in Prenzlauer Berg. I'd be over there all the time. Are there any locations that you would recommend that people visit in Berlin to better understand the GDR?
Yeah, I think there's a few outside of the obvious ones. Obviously, go to the GDR Museum, the DDR Museum there. That's worth a visit. I like how they tried to recreate GDR life. And then kind of off the beaten track, which I know you enjoy as well, you know, is the statue of Ernst Stallman on Greifswalder Straße. So I was really surprised the first time I came across that because it was quite near the hotel I was staying. And I was just out for a run, running through this park, and there's this, you know, very Soviet style statue of Ernst Stallman, who was one of the communists before he got murdered in the Second World War by the Nazis. He was the leader of the German Communist Party. So that's really cool to go and go and see. And
have you heard the story about his nose?
No.
I'm sure I read this somewhere, but it does sound a bit of a dodgy story. But anyway, apparently they put a heater in his nose because in winter you'd get an icicle forming.
Oh, wow.
Off the end of it. I can't remember where I read that.
I wouldn't be surprised because he was revered. I mean, you know, he was like the forefather of the movement up there with Rosa Luxemburg.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, what's also fascinating is so that park, they also built some flats as they were wont to do in East Berlin to house the proletariat, and later found out that they built those flats on, you know, fields that were contaminated with some kind of gas. So that all had to be fumigated after the wall came down. And there's some good footage online of Honecker going there for the opening of the statue and, you know, waving to people up in the apartment blocks when they were built. So, you know, that's the beauty of what we have today is YouTube, just finding these clips and being able to watch that clip and then go to the place and try and imagine that happening. So I do like the Ernst Thälmann statue. Also, the Sport Forum is worth a visit. Now, the Sport Forum is way out in East Berlin, and it's where Dynamo Berlin would play home games. Mm-hmm. There's also the big swimming baths there. And it's, again, very Soviet-style architecture for their sports. And just going over there and you know, you can still get into the football stadium. It's all overrun, grass growing over the terraces. But just to sit there and think, wow, you know, Milka was here, and this is where Dynamo played some of their big games. Though they did move to the stadium, the Jahn Sport Park, for a lot of their bigger games. So they kind of straddle between the two. But that's a good place to go. And again, just when you've read these books or watched the YouTube clips, just to go and let it all you know, sink in.
And by the way, if anybody's interested in East German football, they should listen to episode 3, because we had a long interview with Craig McCracken about the strange world of East German football.
And that was a phenomenal episode. I really enjoyed that, and I learned a ton. Got a few books here on the GDR scene. Unfortunately, quite a few of them were in German, of course, but great pictures. and I enjoyed that. And actually, it was funny. I was thinking when I was listening to that episode last week that I actually did get to see one Dynamo Berlin game, and unfortunately it was an away game, and it was one of the most surreal experiences. It was some small village, I can't remember the name of it now, outside Berlin, and I'd got in contact with some supporters of Dynamo Berlin, and they picked me up outside the stadium, drove me out there, and it's just weird to see. Some of them were very right-wing, shall we say?
Yes.
Very right-wing.
So I understand.
But then the weird thing was, some of them still had GDR flags and badges and wanted the GDR back. I mean, it was just surreal.
Wow.
Surreal. And in fact, if you go to the Sport Forum, which is way off the beaten track, but I say it's worth going out there. They have, you know, the big pictures of, you know, some of their star players in the past around their old clubhouse and the GDR flag. It's like, you know, a little bit of walking into a time warp. And that's all changing because there's a lot of renovation going on over there. They're also renovating the Jahn Sport Park, which is fascinating to me for two reasons. That sport park, the floodlights are incredible. You've been there, right?
No, I haven't. So tell me about the floodlights, Shane. I'm on the edge of the seat.
Yeah, this is floodlight porn. Here we go. They just rise up like Triffids. It's a very 70s retro design that you don't see anymore. And as you walk through Prenzlauer Berg towards the ground, they just rise up. And there's something quite moving about them, I think. Just 'cause you don't see those floodlights anymore. And of course, that ground is just meters away from where the wall was.
Yeah.
And where the death strip was. And again, you just say, this was the East Germans building these at the time very modern floodlights to show off to the West. Look what we've got. Same as the TV tower.
Yeah.
Very retro.
But I think you're right. I mean, you know, to find sort of genuine sort of East German architecture and design in Berlin is more and more difficult. I mean, you've got the obvious places like Karl Marx Allee with all the, you know, the apartment blocks. And also, you know, Alexanderplatz, you've still got the House of the Teachers there with that fantastic mosaic on the side. So if you look around, you can, you know, you can find these spots. Have you been to the Memorial to the Socialists in Lichtenberg, I think?
Lichtenberg. No, I was meant to go there last time I was there, but with it being winter time, everything got dark by 4 o'clock, so I didn't get over there. That's where the cemetery is, correct?
Yeah. That's where, well, I'm not sure the remains of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht are there.
I think they're supposed to be there, right?
Yeah, but I'm not sure they, you know, probably found, because I mean the whole place was flattened by the Nazis.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you know, it's quite an amazing place. And when I went there, somebody or people had laid red carnations on almost every stone around it, and it was, you know, it was quite a amazing amazing sight. And Milka is buried in the same cemetery, but he's in some unmarked grave somewhere.
Because Wolf's buried there as well, isn't he?
Yeah,
with his brother. Yeah, it's definitely on my list, and that's the kind we're talking about here. It's like off the beaten track. It's not where, you know, a tourist guide's going to take you. They're going to take you to Checkpoint Charlie, which is worth going to visit. But when you get there, and right next to Checkpoint Charlie, you see KFC and Starbucks. Yeah. It kind of takes away from what that site was. And if you haven't read your history and, you know, watched the YouTube clips, you would just, it's hard to comprehend that those events happened right there. And I always think of, you know, the start of the movie, The Spy Who Came from the Cold, with Richard Burton, Alec Lemus, you know, lurking around the hut, looking out for his guy to come over the border. It's, well, it's radically different from that now, but it's still, yeah, I think you do have to still go and see it. Same as the, and I know you've been there, which is the Chenin Palace, the Palace of Tears.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that's free to get in, which is always good. That's well worth a visit.
Yes, that is. And you know, I remember telling you on the interview I did with you on Spybury about, you know, crossing through Checkpoint Charlie and, you know, crossing at Friedrichstrasse as well, and how...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Sort of heavy duty the crossing was in terms of how you were scrutinized.
Yes.
I think Checkpoint Charlie is quite disappointing.
Of course, you have to go to the Berlin Wall Memorial at Bernauerstrasse. I think Bernauerstrasse is just one of those iconic sites when you look at the photographs of being split right, the street being split right down the middle.
Yeah. And the church in the middle of no man's.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And I think they've done a really good job of, this is the opposite to Checkpoint Charlie, because you go to the Berlin Wall Memorial, you climb up a couple of steps of stairs, and you can see they've reconstructed the death strip. Because this is the thing that a lot of people also don't understand. They think, oh, it's just one wall, you know, shimmy over that. It's like, oh, no, no, on the western side, it was just one wall. But the eastern side, there was a few obstacles, like, you know, automatic guns set up and mines and Alsatian dogs and whatever else you had to get before you got anywhere near that wall. And they've recreated that. And again, it's one of those wonderful things in Berlin that's free, so it doesn't cost anything. But it's you just really visualize how difficult it was to get over that wall in the end, you know, by the 80s when they had all that fortification.
Yeah.
I think they've done an outstanding job. And they have an exhibition in there as well. And I always remember when I was in there last, they have the little visitor's book, you know, and I was on a little look around and everyone's saying, you know, great history, thanks for doing this. And some guy had written on it, give us our wall back. In German. And I was like, wow. You know, I mean, this is thing that doesn't really get discussed very often, is the fact that there are still people out there that wish there had not been, you know, that the wall hadn't fallen and that the GDR was still there. And it doesn't get spoken about a lot in the mainstream media.
What did you think of the Stasi Museum?
I enjoyed it. I think it could do with having more in English.
Yeah,
You know,
I haven't been there for a while. Sorry, I haven't been there for a while, so I just wondered where they updated it, and I know I had the same problem.
Yeah, so from the first time I went there, which probably was the mid-2000s to now, yeah, they do have more stuff in English, but it's still not all of it's still not translated. And I really wish they would do it, because I think more people would go and visit, more people would understand that history. I think they're making efforts to do that, but it's still a lot of it's in German.
But seeing Milka's office, I think, is probably the main attraction, certainly for me anyway, seeing where he worked from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to walk through his office and even, you know, see his private kitchen and bathroom. I think, wow, you know, the guy was head of the Stasi, you know, was here, you know, the little TV that he watched and his telephones. And because we're geeks, and I'm sure everyone who listens to your show is a geek, you know, I just looked at those phones and thought, oh, I wonder what conversations were had through there.
Yeah.
You know, just to be a fly on the wall. And I really liked how in Deutschland 83, the TV show, that they recreated a lot of those rooms in the same style. I think they actually might have even filmed it at Normannenstrasse, although I couldn't swear to it, but they were very similar. And I also remember that when I was there last, I was listening to Berlin Game, Len Dayton, and I had the audiobook. And, you know, like you, I love walking through Berlin, and I had the audiobook on, and it was the end of, and I've got to be careful, I don't have any spoilers here, but let's just say there is an interview in Normannenstrasse with one of the characters. And just the way Len Dayton had described Normannenstrasse was almost identical to the one I had just looked at. I remember being really struck by that, because I'd come out of Normannenstrasse, went on my walk, and then I got to the part of the book where the character's taken in there for interrogation, and the way Len Dayton described it. And actually, in one of Rob Mallow's, who does the wonderful Dayton Dossier website, he's a Q&A with Len, and I submitted a question, like, how did he get that so right? And he hasn't answered it yet, because apparently he's busy, but I was thinking that, you know, probably it's not as, you know, as clever as I thought, because I'm pretty sure all the buildings were the same in the GDR. So you've been in one, you've probably been in them all, the government buildings anyway. And I remember near our office, there's a customs building, and you can go in there, and it's like a canteen where you can have, you know, a cheap meal. And this was an old GDR building. And again, it looked very similar to Normannenstrasse. I mean, there's not much color in these buildings.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you been to the prison at Hohenschönhausen?
That, believe it or not, is still on my list of things to do.
That is a must see. I mean, it's really powerful, and particularly if you get shown around by somebody who was in prison there.
Yes.
It really does.
And I think that's why I haven't gone, because I don't think they do the English tour every day. So okay. I wanted to wait for when I was there and I could do the English tour. But yeah, I agree. In fact, one of my colleagues was telling me he lives up near there. Now, I don't know how true this is. I got no reason to disbelieve him. He said that one of the former guys who ran that prison still lives around the corner.
Wow.
In his old apartment. And apparently, you know, he gets drunk a fair bit and things get shouted out in the street.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is the cool thing about where one of our offices is in Prenzlauer Berg. It's in the part of Prenzlauer Berg, which is not the fashionable part, because of course it's been gentrified now. So this is on the borders. And I walk around there, and I've drunk in quite a few pubs, as you can imagine. And some of the conversations I've had there are really surprising with the older guys, going back to that all, hey, you know, not everything was bad under Honecker. They're the kind of conversations that I really enjoy having, because
it's
that different side that you don't really get to read about or hear about. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I had some other questions. I mean, do you think, you know, in the course of your reading and looking at the GDR, is there anything you think that a lot of people may be unaware of that you've come across or has surprised you in... you know, what you found?
I don't know about surprise. I think for me, it's still black and white for a lot of people. East Germany was bad. It was bad for its people. No one liked living there. And I think there are still a large amount of people that, I guess, are nostalgic for the past, because, you know, they've been in a situation. You just have to look at the latest election results in the eastern part of Germany, where the AfD, the right-wing party, won a huge amount of vote. Mm. There's still a lot of disenfranchisement in the former East.
Yeah.
And that either goes to the extreme right, or you have, you know, the leftist party still doing quite well. So I don't think it's as cut and dried as the media will have you think. But definitely with the younger people, I saw a great interview with Jonas Nye, is it, who played the main guy in Deutschland 83, and they said, so are you a West German or an East German? He said, I was born in 1991. I'm a German.
Yeah.
So for the younger generation, that doesn't come into play. I think for the older generation, they can remember certain things. I think I read, so if you were a gardener in East Germany, you had it made, because I think they had something like a million allotments. And you can still see them. In fact, to walk to the Sport Forum, you can cut through all these allotments. So because everyone was living in these, you know, apartments in the Plattenbau, the East German government gave you allotments where you could go and grow food. Childcare was extremely good. There was a place for every kid in nurseries and, you know, kindergarten education. But there was always another side to that. So, yeah, great that they had these places for children to go. But then when kids were there, they had to learn songs like, you know, I Want to Be a Vopo. So the indoctrination started at a very early age. And the same as we talked about with education. I mean, there was free education, but not if your parents were rich or part of the, you know, the elite. You weren't allowed to go to university. And in fact, I was talking to somebody else in East Germany who was telling me she was a school teacher. In East Berlin, who was a school teacher. And she was a fervent believer in the SED. She went to all the events. She was, big supporter. They would not let her become a member. And they wouldn't let her become a member. I think it's because her parents were quite well off. And they were like, even though, you know, I go to all the events and I teach the kids and everything else, they would not let her be a member of the SED.
Wow.
I mean, you just scratch your head and think, well, I mean, so there was that whole Marxism-Leninism thing of, well, we want to be for the proletariat, but they took it that step too far.
Yeah.
The other thing that is interesting is way before it's ahead of its time is recycling. These Germans were very, very good at recycling everything because A, they needed the raw materials, and B, they would get paid for taking the plastics to the refuse dumps, the recycling dumps. So Germany was actually very, very strong on recycling. Now, are these things that justify the state, a one-party dictatorship? No, of course not. But I think these are what older former East Germans are hankering after, that community spirit where the lawns got mowed. You know, there was a job for everybody. There was, you know, full employment, even though the country was going bankrupt. I mean, you have to ask yourself, if the wall had not come down, how long could East Germany have carried on for?
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of questions around that, you know, not just about the one party state, but was that level of support and welfare part of the reasons why the country was going bankrupt? I know they had to bankroll that huge secret police force.
Yes.
But, you know, that just became unsustainable. But we're verging onto politics here.
Well, I mean,
I think it's it is part of the conversation around, you know, the GDR, because I think you're right. You can't say it was all bad. You can't say it was all good either. There are loads of shades of grey there.
There are, and I think it's important to talk about it. I wish more people would talk about it. And I remember my Christmas party last year in Berlin, having a few drinks, and a colleague came up to me and she said, "Oh, I'm really surprised. You know, on your Facebook, you have pictures of East Germany." I thought, "Oh, here we go. I'm in trouble here, right?" Because I'm very aware of that. Like, you don't know if this woman.
This will come up in your performance review this year.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Got to be careful. Apparently, one of my colleagues, I don't know which one, but his parents escaped in a boat. And so I don't make this very obvious at work. But anyway, she came up to me. She goes, "Oh, you have these pictures." I was like, yeah, I'm really fascinated in the history, blah, blah, blah. And she says, "I have to tell you," she said, "I was a young pioneer and I was very young when the wall came down." She said, "It wasn't as bad as they say." So you had somebody who was really young saying that. And that, again, is the fascinating thing. This country has disappeared. And, you know, I asked her, I said, "Do you miss the GDR?" And she said, "Yes, I do."
Wow.
And she would have been born probably, 85, like 1980 or something like that.
Right, okay.
You know? So very, very. It's very interesting to talk about the different things. And she was telling me another interesting story where I think it was one of her relatives went to visit grandparents in East Berlin before the wall went up. And then the wall went up and he couldn't get home for 6 months. I mean, I'm surprised he was allowed back at all. But that's also the fascinating thing. You know, where were you when that wall went up? Could you get home again? Were you stuck?
Well, we could have gone on for hours, and indeed we did. So I have split this interview into two episodes. That was the end of episode one. If you liked what you heard, please leave a review at iTunes or your preferred podcast provider. It really does help me to spread the word. The show notes are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 4. There's many links to the areas that we discussed. And don't forget to join the discussion at our Facebook page. Just search Cold War Conversations. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Thank you for listening. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.